I'm Rachel Newton.
And I'm Lauren McCall. Welcome to the Heal and Harrow podcast.
The 16th and 17th century Scottish witch trials were one of the darkest periods of Scotland's history. An estimated 2,500 people, mostly women, were executed and many more accused. With Heal and Harrow, we seek to pay a humanising tribute to these women while also exploring historical beliefs in the supernatural and modern-day parallels in our society today.
Our project takes the form of an album and a live show. The music is based on specially commissioned works by celebrated author Mary Kidd, tales inspired by and in remembrance of real women who were persecuted and tried as witches, and characters from the folkloric tales and mythology enshrined in our oral culture. These stories form part of her brilliant book, We Are All Witches.
In this podcast, we discuss the woman who inspired the work, Mary's writing process, and how we went about creating our musical response. We'll also hear excerpts from the stories themselves, read by 10 brilliant women from across Scotland.
Do click the subscribe button to make sure you catch each episode as soon as it's released. And if you would like to rate and review, that would be much appreciated as it really helps us reach more ears. You can find links to purchase our album, Mary's book, and download the story readings in full at healandharrow.com.
This week's episode is Behind the Eyes, read by Scots poet and writer Len Penny. Here's Mary to tell us more about Behind the Eyes.
Margaret Aiken was from Fife, and she was accused of witchcraft in 1591. So that's in one of the sort of early panics. She was known as the Great Witch of Balwearie. So she was obviously seen as a pretty serious witch. And of course, Margaret, having been found guilty, there was only one sentence. And so Margaret took a kind of a deal that she instead would use her magical powers, which she claimed allowed her to identify other women as witches. She said that she could look into their eyes and tell whether or not they were a witch, obviously using witchcraft. And so she kind of did a deal whereby she put this supposed power into the service of those who were managing the process of justice. And so off she was carted around the country, including she came over west, and they basically lined up the accused or the suspect. And Margaret had a keek in their eyes and said, guilty or not guilty. They caught her out, though, because they became suspicious, which is fascinating when you think about it. You know, what bit of it did they find implausible? But they obviously became suspicious and they took away, I think it was two women that she'd condemned or the opposite, brought them back in different clothes and she didn't recognise them and she gave the opposite verdict, as it were. And so that was her. And she was exposed as a fraud. And so she suffered her own fate, her own sentence. But they think that in some ways, the sort of exposure of Margaret's fraud possibly helped bring that particular period of frenzied witch hunting activity to a bit of a close, because there was a bit of egg on the faces. But a really miserable story. And in some ways, I really did just completely fictionalise her life and imagined a backstory for her as the daughter of a midwife and a healer, and someone who in the end is really thinking about her own guilt for things that have happened to her in other times of her life and things she's done. And so she's kind of at the end of her life, and she's sort of, I suppose, in some, the way that many people are inclined to do, she's finding things to blame herself for, because of course she's not guilty of the ultimate one, which is witchcraft.
I think what's really interesting in this one, and I think we'll probably touch on this in future episodes, but the idea of finding these different aspects of the witch trials where the person involved isn't necessarily, you know, it's not straightforward as they were accused and executed as witches. There's something else. They play a different role somehow. And that importance, I suppose, to show those other aspects. Like we've talked about before, these stories are quite often very similar. It's really interesting that you found these different ways of looking at the experience.
Yeah, and I think when we were selecting the stories, it might be fair to say that, you know, we had the conversations that we had jointly, and you had both kind of identified women that you were particularly interested in, or themes or places. I was probably a little bit constrained to the ones where the information was relatively readily available because we were right in the middle of a lockdown. And, you know, so the best documented cases in some, in a sense, were the obvious ones to write about. But you're right, it was necessary to find other kind of elements of the story. But one of the things I think is interesting about, you know, this whole that they were carting poor old Margaret around to accuse other women, there is something always, isn't there, about weaponizing someone who, you know, is a victim to kind of perpetrate the evil. And also, I think, you know, it does give you a kind of feel for just, you know, how much apparatus was behind this. You know, they were really serious about it. It wasn't enough to have identified one witch. You know, they were absolutely for rooting out all the others. I mean, Margaret feels very guilty in the story. She feels very guilty for the fact that she's done this to all of these other women. But on the other hand, I can't see how we can condemn her for it, because what choice did she have? And, you know, in the end of the day, you know, they didn't believe in her innocence or anyone else's. So I have more pity for her than anything else.
Yeah, I mean, she was just trying to survive.
Yes, and they say, you know, under pain of death, that many people will do almost anything. And, you know, she was under pain of an awful death, a belief possibly that, you know, she was off then to the fires of hell, that, you know, she would have no resting place, her family would have nowhere to mourn her. So, you know, in a sense, you can see that that tremendous fear would have perhaps motivated her to do what she did.
Flea bites form a perfect red ring on Margaret's belly, and judging by the burn on her behind, there is another circle of welts rising there too. It is little wonder that the place should be flea-ridden. The straw on the bed is filthy, crushed by the weight of who knows how many strangers, tainted by their sweat, stinking of their excretions, and teeming with the parasites they carry in their filthy travelling clothes. All the inns in which they have kept her have been slovenly places, but this is by far the worst. The landlord's hands made her shudder, the nails crusted black and the skin ingrained with dirt. The smell of unwashed clothes almost knocked her off her feet, immune as she should be by now. In childhood, Margaret's mother taught her to mix marigold, lavender and yarrow in the rushes strewn on the floor, and her bedstraw had never gone more than a season before being changed. At the thought of her mother, Margaret's eyes smart. Long dead though she is, Margaret thinks of her daily. Now, though, she is almost glad Mother is not alive to see how low her daughter has fallen. Mother was an honest woman, a midwife and a healer, clean and trig and kind. She had a cool, crisp smell about her from the herbs in which she steeped her linen, and the tinctures and infusions she used in her work. In these days, perhaps they would have called her a witch too. Did she not aid the occasional woman who sought to slip a bairn, or help end a life once the pain had become unbearable? Once she even drew a living babe from the womb of its dead mother, her heart barely stilled before Mother had made her decisive cut. It was unfortunate that that gory childbed was the first that Margaret had assisted at, aged just 12, and she immediately determined that it would be the last. She knew that Mother was disappointed, although she never said a word. She would often cast a rueful look at Margaret as she rushed to dress herself in the night whenever there came a knock at the door. Margaret never could meet her eye. In the end, Mother took another apprentice, a girl called Jonnet. Margaret was surprised by the hot rush of jealousy she felt any time she came across Mother and Jonnet, heads bent together over the herbs they were pounding, or a drawing Mother had made in charcoal to show the presentation of a footling babe. Jonnet died of the sweating sickness one May afternoon in the last year before it disappeared for good. Her father said she had risen in an odd humour that morning, feeling unco and dowy for no reason she could name. She was taken then by a violent fit of the shivers and cried out about an awful pain in her head and her neck. She passed the forenoon in that way, alternately in the grip of the shivers and of the pains. At mid-lousing time she seemed to rally, released at last from the awful cycle of pain and cold, and she said she thought she could take some broth. Once she had drunk it up, she said she was hot, and a sweat broke out on her brow. It passed soon enough, though, and Jonnet said she felt much better, only she was tired and would stretch out on her bed. Only then did her father think to send for Margaret's mother, and he never thought to keep Johnnet awake. By the time Mother arrived, she was gone. Margaret offered to help Mother lay Johnnet out, but Mother gave her a sharp look and said she could manage very well by herself, thank you. Margaret drew back, stung, and crept away. When they came to take Margaret up more than 40 years later, saying she was a witch and an enchantress, a lover of the devil, she thought on Johnnet. Had she desired the other girl's death? Certainly, she had wished her gone, and out of Mother's affections. Mother mentioned her at the last, Johnnet, said she had always felt she had failed her. If only she had been sent for sooner, she would have walked her round and round the room until the sickness had broken. That was 20 years after Johnnet died, and even then a dark stain of envy bloomed through Margaret's breast hearing her name. Had Mother truly loved Johnnet so well that she would have risked her own life in that awful sick room? Margaret was a grown woman by then, of course, and she was immediately ashamed of herself, thinking ill of a girl who died before she was even fully grown. Perhaps her mind was wandering. She had barely slept in those last weeks of Mother's life, sitting up by the bed to tend to her every need. She thought of it as a making of amends.
Something we've touched on in previous episodes is the kind of healing and midwifery aspect. It's something Rachel and I have been asked a lot in interviews, or perhaps there's just a preconception that the majority of these women and all of the accused had these skills. To what extent do you think that was the case? Or as you touched on before, was it that this knowledge was readily available to a lot of people at the time? Or do you kind of feel like sometimes it's the easy route for people just to say they were all healers?
I think it's an attractive route because there have been narratives through theories that essentially the witches were, Scotland's witches, I'm meaning, were a sort of survival of some older female-centred religion or religious practices or spiritual practices. And therefore, you know, they really were witches. Then you've also got the fact that the witch in literature is often the healer, the midwife. Interestingly, the healer, midwife, witch is often seen as somehow kind of living outside the village, which is funny. Like my aunt was a professor of midwifery. I made it sound like she was a goner. She's not. She's just retired. And, you know, I can tell you she just lived in a town like anyone else. So there's a sort of, I think we've got a kind of mythos almost. We've got all these patchworks of ideas taken from, you know, anything from Terry Pratchett to, you know, some slightly, I think now we recognise crackpot ideas. I can see why they appealed to say, you know, this is actually women's history. And I think it is women's history, but not in such a simple and pleasing way. It doesn't just give us an insight into midwives and healers and what they were like. We know in terms of, you know, who's mentioned as a specifically as a midwife or a healer. I forget if it's 2 or 4% of the cases we know about in Scotland. It's very small anyway. I think it's 4. There's a lot we don't know. We don't know much more than we do in terms of, you know, survival of records and so forth. But we did, as it happened, I think there are a lot of midwives and healers in the book. And partly that's because I think that there is value in talking about those elements of women's lives. But for example, Margaret helps her mother, but that's not why she's accused of witchcraft. She's not accused of folk healing as malevolent magic. Some people think that if midwives were vulnerable, partly it was also perhaps because they were party to private information, say about parentage of children, that kind of thing, that, you know, there might have been a couple shut up for that sort of reason. I think the idea of childbirth and other experiences we probably need to remember is they were more communal experiences. There would have been more women supporting their, you know, sisters, neighbours, friends through labour, through childbirth than currently happens. And a lot of people would have had basic healing skills because, you know, it wasn't like they were going to phone up a GP. They were going to need to do their best they could themselves. It's an area that I like writing about. I think it's really interesting. Like, for example, I read years and years ago in a brilliant book called The Prospect Before Her by Olwen Houghton. She has a theory that We think that more women died in childbirth than did, because our records are mostly about the upper classes, the aristocracy, the nobility. And actually, they had a totally different attitude to, they were less likely to be physically fit because, you know, they weren't working in the fields while they were pregnant. They were more likely to be attended by a medical person. And actually, in certain eras, being attended by a medical person was more likely to have an adverse outcome before the understanding of the need for antiseptic. And so, you know, I think that there's all sorts of ways that we can use the witch trials to kind of peer through into women's lives, but without perpetrating, I suppose, the idea that, oh, this was just a way to keep down these women and their power and their knowledge. And what, again, is important for me is nothing unites them except that they were accused of witchcraft. And of course, some men were accused too. Some because women were accused, so males who were related to them were accused, but some were accused in their own right. I get irritated when I hear, oh, they were this and that's why they were accused. And it's like, no, they were accused because someone accused them. They weren't accused because of any particular characteristic that they had or didn't have. And I think, you know, it's almost kind of getting to sort of a level of victim blaming if we imagine that they did something.
It's interesting that people often seem to find that difficult to get their head around. It wasn't because of something they'd either done or who they were, what they practiced or whatever. It does seem like a difficult concept for people to kind of really get their head around.
I think we might be a little bit wedded in the modern era to a slight politics of victimhood, and people kind of feel a kinship to people in the past who were victimised for lots of reasons. But we need to recognise that the circumstances are so very different. And really, what did you have to do to be accused of witchcraft in Scotland? You just had to be alive and be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
It was a canker in the breast that killed Mother. As soon as she found the knot under her arm, she said she knew. It took its sweet time, though. Or perhaps she fought it, though she said that she would not. Margaret was well trained in healing by then, having finally taken her place by Mother's side in the year after Johnnet died. At the end, when Mother raved and cried aloud in pain, Margaret brewed a strong infusion of nightshade, sweetened with honey, and held it to her lips. Mother's eyes cleared then for a second and looked into Margaret's. She knew. She drank and lay back in Margaret's arms to await the end. Margaret thinks often of that last look that passed between them. She has cause to, after all, for is it not her trade now, looking in the eyes of other women? As once she could have put her hand inside a labouring mother and said how long there was to go, now she can peer into another woman's eye and gauge from the contractions of the pupil whether or not she has secrets to hide. Margaret is quite the expert in twitches and quivers. She sees fear and calls it evil. This is the bargain she has struck, as once she traded her life for Johnnet's to find her way back into Mother's affections. When they accused her and chained her, they kept her walking for days until she raved and dreamed they were in the cell with her. Mother with her swollen breast and Johnnet in her white sweating, and that woman they cut open so long ago, struggling to hold her belly together with her hands while all the waters of her womb spilled forth between her fingers and her babe fell blue to the ground. Margaret would have done anything then to escape those spirits and their torment, and so, of course, she told the elder she was a witch, and moreover, she was the very witch of witches. She could look into the eyes of any woman and discern the evil secrets of her soul. They were delighted, the blackguards, and excited even to have a woman in league with them, accusing her fellow witches while they sat back and ordered the faggots and the rope. By the time she acquires her flea ring branding, enough, probably, to condemn another wife as a witch, Margaret has travelled half of Scotland and accused dozens of women. She has peered into an aura of irises and seen no more than a rebellion of anger, fear, or worry, pain, or sickness. Nonetheless, she has girded herself and called those women evil. She is weary, and sickened, and ashamed, and after a while she glances into those eyes as briefly as she decently can before she looks away and makes her judgment. And so, when they take two women away, women she has condemned as witches, and dress them in new clothes and bring them back. She says they are not guilty. No evil in them. None at all. You would think that one who stared so closely in another's eyes would recognise those same eyes when they peered into them not 2 hours later. Margaret does not. She has begun to see Mother's eyes instead, or Jonnet's, and flinch from their gaze. She no longer knows the difference between a twitch of guilt and the narrowed hardening of disgust. When they say they will burn her, Margaret is almost relieved, for while she never started as a witch, she is a witch now in truth. For has not a woman who has sent her fellow women to the flame truly sold her soul to the devil? Margaret will confess again. This time she will admit she is a fraud. Anything to buy herself the small mercy of strangulation before the horror of the fire.
In terms of putting together the music for Behind the Eyes, the melody in this track, which forms the basis of it, is simplistic in one way, but at every repetition of the melody, there's a small nuance, something just a little bit different. And I suppose across the album, when you actually analyse what's going on melodically, harmonically, there's a lot of repetition. But within that repetition, there's always something slightly added or a little nuance, something that's a little bit different. I suppose without being too literal about that, it's a reference to how so much of this stuff was he said, she said, and the Chinese whispers element of, oh, she did this, and before you know it, it's grown arms and legs, but just small amounts. That was something I'm not sure that we did completely consciously, but I've noticed it across the music, and certainly within this track there's just these little subtle changes.
Did you work in, as it were, chronologically the tracks as they appear, the order they appear, did you work on them in that order, or was it more organic than that? I've always been interested because it feels like one piece sometimes, although each piece is its own. It feels like a suite to me.
I like that. But I don't think we did work on it. I think we did start with Lilius. It almost feels like we kind of worked on that every day that we were in the studio. We kind of came back to that and it sort of informed somehow the sound of the other pieces. So in that sense, you know, that was kind of the beginning, started at the beginning. But in terms of the rest of the tracks, it wasn't chronological, I don't think, what
no.
I can remember.
The very first time that Rachel and I got together to work on the music aspect, we'd been chatting on Zoom just like we had with yourself for so long and working on research together on Zoom. But we got together in Edinburgh for 4 or 5 days and kind of just sat and immersed ourselves in all the notes we'd been taking individually, all the books that we'd been buying. Amazon Prime was definitely did a roaring trade in those days. There was some kind of witch writing arriving at the door every 2 minutes. And yeah, and sat with that and kind of just actually, well, enjoyed A, being in the same space and being able to have that work in dialogue. But then just, I suppose, trying to get an overarching sense of what the sound was going to be, what we wanted it to be. And I do remember this kind of funny thing that happened during that time, which was we were having a little look at the survey, Scottish Witchcraft, and talking a lot. We'd been reading the Gaelic Otherworld book and coming across all these little bits of folklore and things about, oh, this woman turned into a midgy or, you know, all the different things of which you've written so well about in the past. And I came across this record of a woman from Edinburgh, I seem to recall, who the thing that she was tried for was that she had turned into a swarm of bees and gone after these other people in our community. And we were just after reading this and saying, like, it's just the epitome of ridiculousness, you know, that that's actually written in records. And that was the very thing that she was accused for. And it's not a comedy. It's actually a real thing that happened. And I picked up my fiddle and I kid you not, I looked inside it and there was a bee inside this fiddle. And I mean, this was like April. I think that, I mean, it wasn't alive, but it had been there for some months, but I just happened to see it just after we read that. And
so Rachel was physically present. She hadn't actually turned into a swarm of bees.
Yeah, she was still there. But listening to the Heal and Harrow podcast, produced by us, Heal and Harrow, and recorded and edited by Grant Anderson. All the music you heard is from our self-titled album, with thanks to Mary Kidd and Len Penny.
You can buy our album, a copy of Mary's book We Are All Witches, and hear the stories in full by visiting healandharrow.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe so you won't miss an episode. Bye for now.